listening to WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It's 94.7, and this is Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence, coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful, as always, for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we have a great show. We're speaking about Russian cosmonaut fan mail with Kate Siddell, Professor Paramita Sen on gender politics and protest, and the president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association, Ken Rademacher. He is a beekeeper, so we'll get into that soon. And if you have any questions for our guests during the show and you are on Facebook, go to 947-WPVC. And we'll take your questions. And if you happen to be a friend of mine and have my cell phone number, you can text me questions as well. And Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am totally here. We paid the bill. Everything is cool. I knew that the check would clear, so everything is totally cool. Yes, I am here. How
fantastic,
are you doing?
Fantastic, fantastic. It was a little bit of a tight squeeze this morning, getting in from Maine, coming into the studio, but we're pros now, I feel.
You've crossed state lines and you're back and see, everything is just fine. You know, I am glad because there's just so much we don't need to talk about now that you've seen the whole Eastern Seaboard. You know, that was going to be my whole question, intro this morning. But since you've seen it all, let's just talk about July 4th, which I do not feel like celebrating at all this year. It seems so weird to be celebrating something that seems so antiquated.
It's so 2012.
Right?
It's so 2008.
Yeah.
July 4th. Yeah.
It's so December. I'm not one to go see fireworks and all of that, but given that, you know, just the whole idea of us reveling in our, you know, in our independence and our liberties and our free speech and all of that, you just want to go. I do anyway. Put my head in the sand until Wednesday.
Well, now being in Maine really made me want to do that as well. And I only got a cursory look at the headlines. And
cursory is good.
Cursory
is very good.
And
that's the way to read these days.
Right, and with some alliteration, I think the curveball. I came up with that. I found out that the curveball is taking over baseball. Did you know that?
I don't mind talking about baseball, so no, go on. Go right ahead.
I know. It's just so hard to get back into politics. Not that I wasn't thinking about it most of the time, but just to get into it. Like, what, you know, I was going to ask you, and we can get into it a little later, like, what has been happening? I don't know much about what's been happening.
Well, it's still on fire since you left. You know, it's still at 11. I'm sure. Well, who knows what's gotten through? But the travel ban stay, you may know, has been lifted, and of course, to great confusion, because now the definition of immediate family, which is permissible still. You can still come in to the United States from those six countries if you have family or like a college or a job, or but the whole family definition has been put into question courtesy of the White House. So if you're a grandparent, if you want to come in, if Nana wants to come in from Yemen, she cannot. You know, all those people all those families where, you know, a grandmother raised you, or your aunt and your uncle, aunts and uncles aren't allowed either. You know, it's just this. Anyway, so it's once again in a new version of itself, another reason that lawsuits have already from states have already been filed for this new version of itself. And I'm not sure if you left before the verdict on Philando Castillo came out.
Yes, I did.
So there's that
depressing
horror.
I saw the part of the video, the most I could tolerate. Oh, it was pretty horrible. But back to the curveball.
Yes, please.
May I throw you one?
Go on.
Sports Illustrated has reported that it's back in favor. Used to be that if you had a fastball, if 60% of your pitches were the fastball or below the 60%, you weren't in the game, so to speak. But it's coming back, and this guy they featured Astros pitcher Lance McCullers, And his fastball looks identical. I mean, his curveball looks identical to a fastball until it drops 9 inches.
That is good.
Yeah. And did you know where the curveball started?
Yemen? No, I don't know. If it's imported, your whole argument is out the window, so I hope it started here somewhere.
Brooklyn. Well, apparently Brooklyn. This lad named William Candy Cummings in 1863, he was tossing clamshells along a Brooklyn beach. Yep.
William's tossing clamshells. Mm-hmm. That's perfect. Sorry. Go ahead.
And
what a curveball.
He got the idea for a curveball. He practiced for 4 years, as legend has
it. 4 years on the east, on Far Rockaway?
Yep. The Hudson. And he, it takes apparently a long time to perfect it. And he played an amateur game on his Brooklyn team against Harvard. They lost. His team lost. But he did subsequently get some fame for his pitch, and he became enshrined in the Hall of Fame. The end.
Wow. Yeah. He probably like got a good Bisquick contract or whatever. Baking soda, something. He must have gotten something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some sort of set him up for at least 4 years of his life or something. No, I didn't know any of that. So thank you for getting me off of current events, which, as you said, cursory is key. I was thinking just sound effects, but since we don't have a soundboard for that, I like cursory. That will do it. Because that guy, as you know, I mean, and you know this analogy, you get in more trouble for leaving an ingredient out of Chopped than this guy gets away with every single day.
Nothing.
You know, one could tweet as he does and hold a job.
I was reading, I'm reading a good book by Naomi Klein, who I've mentioned before in the program, called No Is Not Enough and Ways to Resist Trump. And she says that he's running on his brand and he's being true to his brand, you know, being amoral and all that. And so there's no way he could do stuff that I don't even want to talk about on Fifth Avenue.
Right.
The only way to really get at him, and I'm only a third of the way through, is to really go for the money. He makes his money leasing buildings and leasing his name around the world. And if his name is suddenly becomes mud, then that's good for us all. So I'll report back, but I think the way to resist among the many, many other ways is to somehow boycott his holdings and his brand.
I'm sure should he ever hopefully get removed from office, I suspect it'll be on something that is so not obvious, just like with Al Capone. You know, it'll be something, but I don't care. Whatever it is that gets him out, be it a hotel reservation in, you know, Saudi Arabia, I don't care. But anyway, I know we're running out of time. So
I wanted to introduce our first guest.
Intercept. You want to throw clam out in the water first, or no? Okay.
It's the main head. I still have a little of the main head.
Okay.
So our first guest is Kate Seidel. Kate grew up in Charlottesville and recently graduated from Columbia University, where she studied Russian language and culture and visual art. Today we're talking with her about fan mail sent to Russian cosmonauts. Welcome, Kate. Are you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Sorry for the delay on the board here. I had to, turn on the mic myself. How are you doing, Kate?
I'm doing all right.
Good, good. So how did you even first become aware that fan mail existed to Russian cosmonauts?
I first found out as part of a history paper that I was writing for a class I was taking at Columbia. One of my professors let me know that people were just starting to study the space race in popular culture in the Soviet Union, and it actually reminded me of when I first got interested in Russia on a field trip with the CHS Science Club to the Air and Space Museum in D.C., and I figured I wanted to go ahead and study what the Soviet space program meant for average Soviet people, and then in a couple of footnotes in the books I was reading, I came across references to these collections of letters.
That is so cool that your mind went that way. I mean, especially, you know, given how prescient, if I rarely use that word, you know, how topical it is right now. I was just wondering how difficult was it for you to obtain access to whatever it is you were allowed to see? How difficult was that?
It was mostly a question of sort of bureaucratic formalities. So I had to figure out beforehand what archives would possibly contain the letters I was interested in looking at, and I could search through their database online. And then I had to apply for grant money to travel to Russia, make sure I had the right kind of visa, get a letter of introduction from the department saying I was doing this research for my senior thesis. But once you go through all those stages, you know, none of the letters are secret anymore. So it's mostly a question of going to the archives, asking the archivist for advice for other collections you might be interested in, and trying to track down all the institutions where people would have sent their mail. Because, of course, nobody actually knew what the cosmonauts' addresses were. They didn't know where to mail their letters. And so they've ended up in the collections of scientific organizations like the Russian Academy of Sciences, or newspapers, which have then given them to state archives or museums. Yeah.
And all of that tracking, at least the stuff you just said, are you doing that here in America before you go, or is that happening once you've gotten to Russia?
So I was able to do a little of it here in America by looking at footnotes of other scholars that had been working on this, and maybe, you know, in their biographies or in their other studies of the space race, they had referenced these collections. But then I also discovered some more sources once I was there.
And can you give us examples of some of these, what they would say? What did people, was there a tendency and a trend, what people wanted to express?
Sure. I mean, so probably 80 or 90% of the letters were relatively superficial. I mean, not in the sense that they were fake. They were still spontaneous. People were genuinely motivated to send these to the newspaper. But they said stuff like, I'm really proud of my country. I'm so proud that we must be the freest country. Our scientists are the best scientists, and that's why we've been able to progress from backwards Tsarist Russia to this great scientific superpower. We've sent the first man into space. We've sent the first satellite into space. I'm so happy to live in this country. I feel close to the cosmonauts. They're sort of average people like me. I bet I have great opportunities here as well.
Yeah. It made me think, why didn't the U.S., you know, why didn't citizens send fan mail to our astronauts? But who knows that they didn't? Did you ever look into that?
Yeah. I think there are collections of fan mail to our astronauts. I think maybe Ohio State might have some.
Yeah.
And I expect that people from other countries also wrote to them. So Soviet cosmonauts got fan mail, some from abroad, a lot from the Eastern Bloc. And I assume that our astronauts also got fan mail from abroad.
Kate, do you know if any of the or all of those letters that you read were published? It seems like such a great way to herald, you know, the Soviet Union. So were they published?
Yeah, that was actually part of how I got into it. So some of these letters were published in the main Soviet newspapers like Pravda and Izvestia. And there were other sort of smaller journals like Aviation and Cosmonautics dedicated most of a whole issue to publishing these letters. And that was very interesting to me because it lets you see sort of what the government was looking for in these letters if you compare the archival collections to the published ones. So I found that for some of the main newspapers, they were interested mostly in situations where people talked about the achievements of the Soviet Union, what it meant for world history. And then in this other journal, Aviation and Cosmonautics, they reported a lot about people's warm feelings of being closely tied to their country, to the cosmonauts, and to the Communist Party.
Do you remember any that were that sounded so off key, considering, you know, the authoritarian government? Do you remember reading any that sounded like trouble for that person that wrote it?
That was an interesting question for me because the letters that ended up in the archival collections, like if they're in the archive, it seems like they haven't been forwarded on to the secret police or anything. So they're probably safe. There were occasions when people did want things to come to the attention of the government. There was only one person wrote in denouncing their coworker for not being excited enough, celebrating Yuri Gagarin's first ever flight into space. And there were some young people who wrote with questions, sort of unsure why, given that the government of Nikita Khrushchev had recently criticized the Stalinist period for being a period of the cult of personality, why they would be building these new cults of personality around the cosmonauts.
Is there anything that really surprised you?
It kind of surprised me in retrospect that most of the letters really don't have to do that much with science. I'd been doing a lot of reading before I went into the letters about the space program and popular culture, and so I thought that a lot of the things people wrote about were going to be specific to space travel. But actually, when I ended up writing about the letters, I found it was easier to just look at them from a general perspective of Soviet popular culture, understandings of the hero, and people's inner lives, stuff like that.
Was there a favorite cosmonaut that was cited? You know, was there like a favorite Beatle in the band that kept getting the most fan mail or anything?
I mean, well, it's hard for me to tell because I only looked at fan mail that was already sent to somebody in particular. I mean, certainly Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, was extremely popular. He had a very handsome smile. He was from a small town. Like, his family were peasants. So, yeah, people were very enthusiastic about him and felt like he was close to them. And then also Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space in 1963, was very inspiring, especially to a lot of young girls who are interested in science. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Did you find any, like, from kids? Were there any arts and crafts stuff, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Or anything with... There was?
Yeah.
Please.
Some people sent drawings. a lot of people wrote poems. A lot of them were cheesy, but occasionally they were good. Yeah, so people definitely talked about how the cosmonaut flights had inspired them either to make these little creative things and send them to the cosmonauts, or maybe they had inspired them to do well in school or to work harder,
right,
or to volunteer in their free time. Yeah.
That is too much. And are there any, you know, that would diss NASA intent, you know, did you read specifically? Oh, go ahead. Sorry. You already know the answer, so go ahead.
No, I actually hadn't thought of that. I think the period that I was mostly looking at the letters from the early 60s, the Soviet Union was actually kind of dominating the space race. And so most of the Soviet citizens didn't really seem that concerned with NASA catching up to them, at least at that point. But they did sort of emphasize that, you know, their country, unlike perhaps other countries, was using the space exploration for peaceful scientific purposes. I mean, yeah, which... Yeah, so basically they were pretty sure that their space program was peaceful and better than other space programs, but they did not diss NASA by name. Yeah.
Gotcha. And do you know if you're welcome back to, not that you want to, but how did you, what kind of terms did you leave on, I guess?
Like with the people who worked on the archives or just sort
correct,
of personally?
Correct, right.
Oh,
like if there was more research you wanted to do.
It was great. It was very encouraging. A lot of the archivists gave me advice. They sort of, I don't know, maybe they liked me because I was young and interested in this subject, but they obviously want to be able to share the collections they have access to. I made friends with people at the Unified Gagarin Memorial Museum, which is located in Yuri Gagarin's hometown. And I'm actually going to be back in Russia, hopefully, later in July, helping a professor at Barnard with a documentary film she's making on similar subjects of popular science and cosmonautics in the Soviet Union.
Wow. I'm glad that the topic continues.
Yeah.
You will have to come back and talk about that.
Yeah.
That's news to me. Great.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost up on our break, and we are talking with Kate Seidel. I hear some music in the background. It's cool. Kate Seidel, she's been talking about Russian cosmonauts. We will be talking very shortly with Professor Paramita Sen on gender politics and protest. And then a little bit later, we'll talk to beekeeper Ken Rademacher. Join us. Welcome back. You're listening to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. We are going to be talking with Paramita Sen very soon and beekeeper Kent Rademacher. Nancy, are you there?
I do.
I got to ask.
I am staring at my two news of notes, and I was hoping that one of them would speak more loudly to me during the commercial break. I have to say, though, I'm just going to go with the one at the top of the list. They both are noteworthy. This one, Ellen, you might not know about since you were away. It just happened yesterday, I believe. There is Trump's administration has created this Commission on Election Integrity, which is not new, but as of yesterday, they have taken this action. They have sent a letter to all the governors, to all the governors requesting all the voter roll information, meaning everyone's political party, your voting history, the last four of your social, all this data And the person that runs it is Chris Kobach, who is notorious before the administration of trying to get voters off the, suppress the vote, illegally disenfranchising voters, et cetera. And the reason I mention it is maybe twofold. It's because of that, which is horrible. But for anyone listening in any state, to call your governor and or your secretary of state and tell them to keep the White House away from your voting data, because it is happening, and even, and it's so, you won't, we won't know which states, unless it gets leaked, we won't know which states are complying and which ones are not. I just saw this morning that New Hampshire is complying, a few, I know Kentucky, anyway. So it's out there and it's happening, and it's, you know, it's why they can, they don't need to win a red state mm-hmm. at 60-40. They can win it, they're fine at 52-48, you know, whatever it takes. So that is mine.
I know.
So what do you got?
Well, I just want to comment, that guy's a piece of work. I think he's the only state attorney general that was, he lobbied to be able to preside over voter registration or something like that in his state. And I remember reading about him. It's really horrible.
Yeah.
And it's really, really, really important, because we always talk about, well, I mean, voting matters. I probably don't need to explain it, but I always get to the point where I'm like, well, we just need to, like, vote him out. And then you realize, oh, it could be totally, you know, rigged by voter suppression. And that
right.
is just extremely scary. So thanks for bringing it up.
Yes. So everyone call your governors. Don't assume your state is safe or your. Anyway, I'm
and you
sorry.
Can
I'm
text.
Just repeating myself.
You
please.
Can text this really cool thing. Just get out your phone and text. I think it's 50. I'll have to talk about it later, but I think it's some 4-digit number, which I don't know. And you just type the word resist.
It's Googleable.
It's
if
Googleable.
You can't recall it. Not
perfect.
Yeah. You know, right. Yeah.
Text to that number and just. Type the word resist, and then you'll get instructions about what to do and what you want to do. It's very, very easy, and your letters are written for you. All you have to do is write a message. It's really amazing. So,
okay.
So my news of note, I'm going to ask Kate to respond, even though she might be on mic, but did she know, do you know, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but I just read that BLOTUS signed an executive order to reestablish the National Space Council. Say that again.
Wow, I had not heard of that.
Okay, so it says it was founded by JFK, disbanded in 93 by the Clinton administration, and the council will lead the charge on creating space policy and will coordinate space spending between NASA, the U.S. Air Force, and intelligence agencies.
Wow, that's mysterious to me.
It is. I mean, it's got to be bad, whatever it is.
Because
I think Pence is overseeing the whole thing. I mean, they're going to, what, sonograms in space now, probably.
I mean, it might not be threatening. It might just be sort of a diversion to try and get people excited about this space program, even when he's slashing the budget in other areas.
Good point. Thanks for that. A bit of optimism.
Maybe Putin and Trump, you know, are going to have a space date. Something like that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a disgusting thought. Okay. Sorry. So our next guest is Paramita Sen. And we're going to... You go by Paro.
Yes, I do.
Great. So... She is a PhD candidate in the politics department at the University of Virginia. Her research focuses on the intersection of gender and social movements, specifically those surrounding issues of women's physical security and violence against women. Welcome, Paro.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So can you tell us, when I read that, what is the crux of this research for you in layman's terms, if you were to explain it to some of us here, layman?
Yeah, let's see if I can do this. I've been an academic speak for too long. So what I'm basically trying to study is there's lots of research on women's movements, right? And how women, there are certain issues that are considered women's movements and how women take to the streets. So we've seen this like recently, even in America, right? You had the Women's March in January. And that's really amazing. Women have a lot of political mobilization. What I focus on, however, is mobilization around women's issues, which doesn't necessarily just mean women mobilizing, but also women and men mobilizing for what is considered women's issues. And I focus on something like violence against women, where you have women taking to the streets because it's something that affects them, but then also men showing up. This is in 2012, I realized there was an increasing trend since 2012 of men and women taking to the streets for in protest of, say, rape against women, right? So women being raped. And then you would see, and this happened like across the developing world. So it started off in India and continues so in India, but we've seen the cases in Turkey, we've seen it in Brazil, Kenya, South Africa. Woman gets raped, men and women take to the streets. And I found that fascinating given the history of how it's always typically been women protesting for women's causes and everybody else pretending like it didn't affect anybody. Mm-hmm. And didn't affect civil society at large. So,
and how do you conduct this research? You know, do you go in, are you working while walking, or do you talk to them before and after? How do you do it?
So a lot of what I've had to do is talk to them after, because as much as I would like it, people don't just take to the streets when I issue a call. So I have to, I basically try to do a selection process where I find out, I interview people, find out if they did participate in a protest or if they didn't participate in a protest and why they didn't do so. I focus on the India case because there have been so many protests in India in recent years, in the last 5 years, that typically either people themselves have participated or they know someone who has. This, of course, has flaws because people are like, they've had some time. They've had about 5 years at this point from like the biggest protest in India to think about why they did protest. So there's a lot of like rationalizing after the fact. But yeah, I basically investigate them after the protest. And then what I've started doing recently is if there is a protest that's not tangential, that's not directly related to the issue, but where I see women and men showing up, I do just attend the protest and then start talking to people on the streets. I follow the news coverage. And basically, yeah, I do work while walking on the streets.
What are some of the findings you've discovered, some of the important bullet points?
Yeah, and this is sort of where my research is going now. I initially just wanted to know why did you have such a diverse group of people all of a sudden protesting violence against women, which typically hasn't been the case. And we're talking like tens of thousands of people. So in India, Delhi, for instance, 2012, December 2013, January, you're talking about close to like 40, 50,000 people clogging the streets for a month. So we're talking really large numbers. Initially, I just wanted to figure out what was motivating them. So one of the findings from that is over time, these protests stopped being so women populated. Women's movements weren't, women's organizations weren't taking to the streets as much because they felt threatened in their own spaces in what was considered a women's movement with the influx, with this becoming a popular issue and a hot topic. You started seeing a lot of political parties showing up and a lot of, weirdly enough, men's rights activists showing up and a very chauvinistic narrative that took over these streets. So a lot of women, students especially, they just stopped going for these protests. They didn't feel safe in their what they had envisioned initially as their own protest space.
That sounds so frustrating. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's absolutely the case. And that was the frustrating part. And since then, we've seen that it's become sort of a norm for governments themselves, it's not just political parties, it's the government in power where they themselves are like, yes, this is an issue, we should protest on the streets, this is a problem. And then the government has begun using violence against women as a way to pass other laws that aren't great for women, but are great for the government, all under the guise of protecting women.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was a question I was wondering is if, sadly, if protest of this sort actually, I don't even like, anyway, can backfire, you know, that all of this unity about, a wrong that needs to be righted actually bites them by the government. And is that sort of what you're suggesting sometimes happens?
Yes, that is what I'm suggesting. It's what I'm seeing happening, and it's a little scary. I was very, very optimistic in 2012 when I started seeing this trend. I thought, yes, this is an issue that people care about. And it is. I've conducted a survey in India where over 94%, I think, of my respondents said that this is an issue that should be political. It's something we should care about. 73% of respondents said that the government should be, that they would vote for a politician based on how they responded to the issue of violence against women. All of this sounds amazing, except the narrative itself isn't a great one because there's this different, they've started using the narrative of we must protect our women. And protecting women is just never a good thing in some ways because protecting women often comes at the expense of taking away women's rights to, say, move around. If you let a woman out after 7 p.m. at night, she might be more at risk of being attacked, so let's just not let women out after 7 p.m. at night. College students in India, for instance, have a curfew of 6:30 p.m. So at 6:30 p.m., the women have to go back into their hostels. And this is under the guise of telling their parents, we're protecting your students. If they're not out, they can't be attacked. There's a great movement that's fighting this right now. It's called Pinjra Tor, or Break the Cage. But it's basically college women, women students, insisting that they don't need to be protected, that they're adults and should be treated as such, while the government says, no, we're doing this to protect you, and therefore CCTV cameras are being installed, so their movements are being monitored. They have to come back home by 6:30. They aren't allowed out. They aren't allowed to have guests. So the idea of protecting women is being used to take away women's rights.
And what actually, that element of surveillance does, to your knowledge, does it affect the people that show up or how people express themselves?
Yes, it absolutely does. The idea that everybody, so a lot of these women, a lot of women and young men, if they want to participate, I mean, my entire research is in the Indian context, but research generally has shown that oftentimes you're trying to break away from your family, especially this age between like 18 and 26, right? You're trying to like develop your own political consciousness, become an adult in your own right, and your family might not necessarily agree. But if you're being surveilled, if there is a way for your family to find out about this, your independence itself is being compromised. If you know that you attend a protest and someone is going to write a letter to your parents, which is what is happening in the Indian case, that's going to, you're not going to end up going to that protest. It starts restricting your behavior and what kind of political action you take. So the surveillance is having consequences. And the government in India is actually using this directly. If you participate in a protest and they find out about it, they won't give you access to the hostels the next day. You will have to figure out someplace else to stay if you participate in a protest.
What are you noticing about locally and in the U.S. With what's going on, or what have you noticed here?
So this narrative actually of protecting women, I've seen it happens in the, it's happening in the U.S. and happens in Europe all over the place, right? So for instance, there was this recent case in Maryland of a student who was raped in her school, or sexually assaulted in her school. It's a problem. We know that high school rape, college rape, this is a problem, like sexual assault in high school campuses and college campuses. But the administration managed to, this is the only time the administration has commented in recent years, and it turns out it's because the accused were two undocumented students. So that narrative is now being used to be like, we need to keep the undocumented out because they're threatening our girls. That became a narrative. Like the parents in that school started being like, yeah, we do. We need to build the wall narrative around the school. It's the only time they've cared. Students are being assaulted across, you know, I mean, it's a problem and we're trying to fight it. And there's some great movements to fight campus sexual assault. But the only time the government weighed, this current government weighed in on this was when it happened to be undocumented students as a way to support a different policy.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing your research, I'll stick with India, or maybe you answer how you want. How do you gain their trust in a place where people are reluctant to attach their name to a comment? How do you gain their trust to do your research?
So I actually thought that would be more of a problem than it was. It turns out people are very willing to talk about these opinions because the idea of so the women who are doing this because they think, you know, women shouldn't be raped because they're full humans and that's just not something you do to another human being, there's no shame for them to talk about it. And I always preserve anonymity when I'm doing research, just in case it's something that UVA recommends when doing academic research anyway. So I do promise them that. But they're very open about it if they're, as you would call, feminists. However, the others who consider themselves as like protecting women and the narrative of taking away women's rights, there doesn't seem to be a shame associated with it. They think they're doing the right thing. They do think that they're protecting women. They don't understand why protecting a woman from assault is a bad thing, even if it means taking away their other rights. The end goal, that a woman wasn't raped, is a good goal. So there's actually, I haven't had a problem eliciting opinions from government officials all the way down to citizens. They're all very open about it, which I didn't expect.
Right, nor did I, actually. Do you have any idea why some protests become more high profile than others? Is there a combination of elements at work, or is it random?
So there's a lot of research that's been done on this, and I find similar patterns. It depends. It's the perfect victim narrative, at least in the violence against women field, right? So who is the right? Is the right, and I'm using apostrophes here, the right woman? So for instance, around Charlottesville, we've seen this case, right? So when black transgender women, for instance, are kidnapped or attacked, no one talks about it. When it's a college student from the university who's got a certain amount of like racial privilege and economic and socioeconomic privilege, then people do care about it. You have candlelight vigils. It's a similar narrative. It depends on who the victim or survivor of the violence is. And you see that case happening in India. You see that case happening. That's just the narrative worldwide.
And when you write about what you call eventful protests, what do you mean by that?
So that's what I'm, when I talk about eventful protests, it's this instance of that one protest that does trigger it. Because women's activists have been fighting violence against women across the board, regardless of the identity of the victim, right? So, I mean, you see this happening in America. When transgender women are being killed right now in America, transgender women of color, people are protesting. They're trying. It just doesn't become a catalyst for large mass mobilization. So what I see in India is that idea that it becomes a mass public issue that everyone wants to talk about, depending on the identity of the victim, if she's the right age, right socioeconomic class.
You're listening to WPVC 94.7. The Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Professor Paro Sen. So what do you want people to know? What would be the main takeaway that you would want people to know from your work?
Yeah, I think what I want people to walk away with knowing is that just because you see a lot of people protesting, it doesn't necessarily mean, and public action is great. You just have to be a little critical and a little aware. Don't let yourself get swept away in the optimism. This doesn't mean be pessimistic. But just be constantly aware of where who's in control of the narrative, who's taking over the narrative, whether there is co-optation, because that is my fear about a lot of progressive narratives across the world, that governments are becoming smart. Mm-hmm. They know how to take over the narrative. So just be aware all the time.
Thank you. That is a great point. Thank you so much for being here, Paramita Sen from UVA. And shortly, we're going to be talking with Kent Rademacher, president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC. Welcome back. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC. This is Apropos of Something with myself, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. I'm here in the studio in Charlottesville. And right now, our next guest is Kent Rademacher. He is president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. Welcome, Kent.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So bees are, I've learned, are very fascinating just from the little I've talked to you, and my girlfriend is a beekeeper as well, so I'm really excited to talk to you. Can you give an overview about the hive? And I know that there are different roles the bees have, and they have different jobs even. Can you talk about the hive?
Yeah, so there's three types of bees in a normal European hive, European honeybee hive. We know about the queen, so she's the focal point of the hive and lays the eggs and keeps the hive going. And then we have a worker class that are all female. And then so if you interact with honeybees, more likely you'll interact with a worker female, and they're the ones that sting. And the other one is the drones, and they're the males. And their sole purpose in life is to mate with queens, and they don't sting, so you can pick them up and they won't bother you. But they don't make it through the winter, so they get pushed out of the hive in the fall, and only the queen and the workers go through the winter.
Is it true they go out? They go out and seek. What do they seek?
Which ones?
The drones.
They go to a place called drone congregation areas.
Is that right?
Yes. And so a queen who hasn't been mated yet, she will take her mating flight, and she somehow knows where these drone congregation areas are, and then she mates with drones, up to 10 or more drones before she comes back to the hive.
And in terms of the apiary, that's where they live, is that?
Yeah, so that's an area where there might be multiple hives that a beekeeper has as an apiary.
Aside from the honey, that's obvious, how does an apiary help the environment?
So mostly through pollination. So there's a class of a lot of different plants that rely on pollinators, insects, to pollinate plants, and that's their main benefit to the local environment is just pollinating.
And why is I get that, but why is pollination so important?
Well, it's what how it? Yeah, so it's how the plant reproduces, and the insects carry pollen from one flower to the next, and pollinate those and transfer by kind of accident. But and then where the honeybee comes in is the plant offers this reward for the work that the honeybee does by pollinating, by giving them nectar. And butterflies take advantage of that. Hummingbirds take advantage of that. Bumblebees, any of the local native pollinators take advantage of that nectar. And that's a reward for doing that for the plant.
So when I was in Maine, I watched some bees, I don't know what type they were, in flower. And they were just, it was fascinating. They were just buzzing around the center of that flower, collecting pollen, I believe. And yep. Then they tucked them in. Did they collect it in on their body?
Yeah, there's on the honeybee, there's their back legs that have these little pollen sacs that they rake that pollen into. And so depending on the flower, the honeybee may only gather pollen on a certain flower because maybe the flower itself is too deep and their tongue isn't long enough. And so you'll see, say on milkweed plants, you'll see a lot of butterflies and bumblebees, but you won't see a honeybee because their flower is too deep. And so it may be they're getting nectar and maybe they're getting pollen.
And can you talk about swarms?
Yeah, so a swarm is how, so you have to think of the honeybee hive as a super organism. And so where the value of any one worker's life is not that important compared to the entire hive. And so you, the hive, in order to spread its genetics, spreads it in several ways. The drones spread the genetics of the hive through mating with other queens. But then they also, the superorganism reproduces by swarming. And so that's where the old queen and half the hive leave and go to start another hive.
So as beekeepers, that's something that they hate because they're lose. What you're saying is they're losing. I know.
Yes. Yes.
They're losing half the hive.
Yes.
And they're like, oh my goodness. So it's not good for the beekeeper, but it's good for the species.
That's right. That's how. Yeah. That's one way that they spread their species out.
And then what's the difference between absconding and swarming?
So absconding is where the entire hive just leaves. Something about the hive, the location, the cavity that they're in, just causes them to leave. And maybe in the wild, it might be maybe a tree falls down and cracks open the cavity they were in. So they're going to take as much honey as they can with them, and they'll go find another place.
And if you happen to see a bunch of bees, you're not a beekeeper, and you see a bunch of bees, it may be that there's a swarm hanging around.
Yes.
What can people do if they see that?
So in the local area or anywhere, there's honeybee beekeeper associations out there across the country. And if you see one, just like in Charlottesville, if you see a swarm, send an email or call us up, and we've got a whole group of people that, because it's free bees, so beekeepers will come and capture the swarm and take it back to their apiary and put it into a hive. But across the country, just look up your local beekeeping, and they'll come get it.
And it's a particularly good time to collect them. Is that right?
Yeah. So in Central Virginia, May and June are when we normally get swarms, and that's a good time to collect them.
But I mean, I know that they're not as quite as stingy.
Yeah. 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 So they look very menacing. There's this huge group of bees around, and but they're at their least menacing at that point, mainly because they have no brood or young to protect, and they have no honey to protect. Don't be too frightened of them. Don't bother them, but they're not as menacing as what it looks.
And I was just wondering, actually, because I know a lot of people are, it seems to be becoming a popular hobby for non-professionals as yourself. So what is involved with, you know, setting up one's own apiary or bee's house?
Yeah, so you can do it several ways. The best way is to work with your local beekeeping club and go take a class. We, in Central Virginia, we offer a class in February for new beekeepers through the Albemarle Parks and Rec department. And it's every Thursday night in February, and you learn from all the local beekeepers how to get started. You can also do it kind of just yourself. When I got started, I had the class always fills up very fast, and I didn't get in. And so I bought a couple books, like Beekeeping for Dummies, which is actually a really good book, despite the title, and just read up through the winter. So this is something, if you want to get started, kind of now's too late for this year because it's very seasonal. But if you want to get started, start researching in the fall and the winter. Take a class if you can get into it, and then early spring is when you start implementing your plan to get started.
What kind of size are we talking about for a person? You know, what size plot of land do they need for their apiary?
Really, not much. I mean, if you live on a quarter acre lot in the city, depending on the local ordinance, you can have bees. It doesn't take any amount of space to have bees. Any typical backyard can have bees in it.
You may want to ask your neighbors or tell your neighbors.
Yes, that's very important, and we stress that in the club, is we want to be good neighbors and respect people's desires.
And how many bees are in one hive?
Depending on the size of the hive, you know, 60,000 or so in a good, healthy hive.
And I know, you know, that even if you don't want to actually have a bee collection in your backyard, you can help bees, like a gardener, a homeowner. They can do things as well to help the native bee population. Is that right?
Yes. Planting bee-friendly. Like I said before, bees can't always harvest the nectars of all the plants because of the different petals or flower sizes. And so planting bee-friendly plants is always good.
Unless it's too technical?
Well, in Central Virginia, you know, I don't have any off the top of my head.
Okay.
But
right.
In Central Virginia, the tulip poplar tree is the crop for, you know, it has that big orange-yellow flower, drips all over your car if you're in the city. And so that's what they go for around here.
Could you talk a little bit about, again, if you want to start, where you would get the bees from, and then a little bit, I just want to touch on the actual structure of the hive, and that if you could quickly talk about that little ratio that you mentioned at one time.
Oh, yeah. So,
maybe first about how people can do.
So to get bees, you can actually get them through the mail, through the post office, or through UPS or one of the shipping companies, and you can order them online now. A lot of the clubs will go in, and there's some local beekeepers here that will sell, that will go down to Georgia. A lot of those package bees come from Georgia. And then also there's some local beekeepers that raise bees and sell them as nukes. And so the first one that you get through the mail is called a package of bees, and it really is. It's 3 pounds of bees. They arrive. You set them on your kitchen table until you're ready to put them into the hive. And what was the other question?
Just that little bit of history about when you set up that hive.
Mm. So there was a particular very important discovery made in the 1800s. I can't remember. I should have looked it up.
That's fine.
by a Langstroth was his name. He was a minister. I'm not sure which denomination. But he discovered something called bee space. And it's about a third of an inch. And what he found, so bees will either fill a space with wax to store honey or raise brood, or they will fill it with propolis, which is a tree resin derivative that they use to glue and varnish the inside of the hive. So they either build honey cells or wax cells, or they'll fill it with propolis and glue it down. And what he found is if I kept the space right at a third of an inch, they won't do anything. They won't. They'll just leave that space alone, and they'll use it as a channel through the hive. So what that allowed us to do is build hives that I could remove, and you've probably seen these pictures, I can remove frames from the hive and manage it and inspect it. And where in the old days, before they realized this, they in essence had to destroy the hive in order to harvest the honey. And so what this allowed was us to let the hive survive through winter and be able to harvest the honey and inspect it.
I think that's fascinating.
That is just it's really unbelievable. It took that long. I mean, humans have been raising raising bees for, you know, thousands of years, and until a couple hundred years ago, that's when we discovered that.
And that allowed people to do it, to become a hobby.
Yes, and yeah.
And has the EPA relaxing so many regulations as far as pesticides affected your line of work, at least in Virginia?
It hasn't affected us to the local as much. I'm not sure about that. There's been some ongoing investigations. There's a big controversy within the beekeeping community about neonicotinoids, if I said that right, insecticides and their effect on the bees. And we've been waiting for the evidence, the actual data to come in to see if there's actually a causation there. But it has been a concern. And there's at this point, I think there's been a lot of anecdotal, and we're just waiting on the data. One of the great things that happened a couple years ago in the previous administration, there's a treatment that the beekeepers needed that didn't have a lot of value, that companies couldn't make a lot of money by providing this treatment for the beekeepers. And so what they did was had the Department of Agriculture apply in place of a company to the EPA in order to get this treatment that we needed approved and approved for use. So it was a great example of how one branch of the government could act on benefit of the beekeeper when there was no commercial value available.
Yeah, separation. We're talking with Kent Rademacher, president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. This is 94.7 WPVC. We have time for maybe one or two questions, maybe just one.
I don't think so. Not on my clock. Are you sure?
Could you give, it's 10:56. Nancy, do you mind if I just ask one tiny one? She's not good. let's hash it out. This is something to think about. You don't have just answer it in like African killer bees, good or bad?
Bad.
Okay.
Yeah, bad.
I saw honey from them, so I was confused. Okay. Nancy, let's thank our guests together. I feel like a round of applause somehow should be coming from our sound effects.
There we go. Oh, yeah.
We don't have any. It's a filler. Thanks to Kent Rademacher from the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. We'll post his information on our page on the 94.7 website. And thank you to Paramita Sen, professor at UVA in the Department of Politics, and Kate Seidel, graduate from Columbia University, and we talked about cosmonaut fan mail. Thank you so much, you guys.
Welcome.
It was excellent.
Some of them are
on holiday weekend. Thank you. Thanks.
Nancy.
Yes, I do. I have a palate cleanser. I will try and condense it. It's sweet news. It has to do with Kent's profession, actually. It's about honey. I learned that you can apply honey to a wound due to its chemical composition. It's got antibacterial stuff in it, and it's an antibiotic, so it's actually good to apply to a wound, and it prevents bacteria from growing, and it also minimizes swelling and scarring when applied. And lastly, it reduces redness in the face as a facial thing. And when I read that, I thought, obviously, Trump knows not the value of honey because his face is truly red. All right, so what do you got?
I'll just add the many benefits of honey. Another one is an exfoliating of your skin. You can put it on and it takes off the dead cells. Honey is good, and it tastes amazing.
There is that.
Well, I mean, like real fresh honey, raw honey from your own hive is really worth waiting for. So thank you again to our guests, and I wanted to give a shout-out to Keller Williams Realty. Thank you for your sponsorship. And our theme music is N3540 19800 by Springtide. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next week. Bye, Nance.
Bye, Elle.